So I just want to acknowledge something that a lot of people have been saying on the listserv, which is that this really is a fantastic conversation that's going on. And everybody who's participated, and I know many of you who aren't writing into the listserv, but who are contemplating these questions and having your own reactions to them, I think we can all agree that this subject, what is my dharma, and all the issues that come up as we contemplate it, are incredibly powerful. They're some of the deep questions of life, especially the questions that relate to action, to the way we act and live in the world. And I want to speak, as we are starting, to a question that came up a couple of times earlier on this week, which is the question of what happens when we try to apply some of the criteria from the Yajnavalkya Samhita to our actual lives. Some of the issues that come up for us when we try to take classical teachings from the texts of the enlightened tradition, and actualize them in life. Sometimes this feels very easy and natural, and sometimes it brings up a lot of stuff. So one of the issues that I have found over the years in actually applying the teachings, the great teachings of the scriptural traditions to my life, is that I've needed to ask the question always, what level of consciousness am I approaching this on? The teachings of the Bhagavad Gita and the Yajnavalkya Samhita actually come from a radically enlightened perspective. They are among the world's teachings that contain very deep, as you know, very deep truths. And at least in the Gita, they also contain some truths that are, we could say, culturally determined. And it's also true that these truths can be interpreted through different levels of consciousness. Since each of us is operating at several different levels of consciousness, often several different levels of consciousness at one time, it's usually extremely helpful, extremely useful to ask yourself when you have a reaction or an experience of getting really excited or really bummed by when you apply a particular teaching to your life. Ask yourself, what level of consciousness is being activated in me by this teaching? You know, part of us, part of all of us here on this call is pretty enlightened, pretty awake. And yet there are other parts of us that are still operating out of our childhood wounds, that are operating out of our conditioning, out of our parental conditioning, the ancestral conditioning that we carry, or the religious beliefs that we've picked up from our culture. And when I say religious beliefs, I also want to include atheism and secularism as religious beliefs. So when we look at the teachings, we're going to see them according to several different levels of consciousness, and especially according to the level of consciousness that we happen to be in at a given moment. So if we're looking at them from a conventional perspective or from our reactivity towards conventional perspectives, which, of course, a lot of us have. I think there's probably nobody in this group who hasn't, in some sense, rebelled against conventional perspectives at some point. That's part of what makes us spiritual seekers, as Sandy said in one of her communications. So if we're in a conventional level of consciousness, we see them as rules of behavior. We actually see them as the rules. And what happens then is we measure ourselves against them, and we use them as a way to feel superior or inferior to others, or superior and inferior to ourselves. So we might feel guilty because we don't measure up, or if we have had a certain kind of upbringing or are at a certain postmodern place in consciousness, we may think, oh, this is just ridiculous. These rules don't apply to me. Because we're playing at a different level of the game. But when we look at the teachings not as rules, not as shoulds, but actually as guides to our deepest intuition about right action. What we begin to recognize is that we're being given some templates for practicing enlightenment. Most interpreters of the Gita believe that Krishna represents the higher self, or let's say the voice of the evolution of consciousness, while Arjuna is the small self walking the path. And if you look at Krishna in context, you do see that he definitely believes that some ways of being, some ways of acting, are, let's say, more conducive to enlightenment than others. Even though Krishna is a non-dualist, and you find statements in the Gita which make it very clear that as far as he's concerned, on the ultimate level, it's all part of the One. Yet at the same time, he very definitely talks about qualities that are, that you know, let's say, are just essentially more enlightened than other qualities, specifically fearlessness, non-harming, truthfulness, equanimity, non-stealing, vigor, discernment, are more conducive to enlightened states, will take us farther on the path to liberation than hypocrisy, arrogance, falsehood, selfishness. Which Krishna, on the level of daily dharma and daily action, very much associates with the people in his story, the people in the backstory of the Bhagavad Gita, the people who are actually destroying the planet as they experience the planet at that time. And of course, if we look at today's world, specifically at the way we're treating the earth, it's very hard not to think that if Krishna were alive today, which of course he is, because the higher self is alive in all of us, Krishna would be encouraging Arjuna to enter into the fight to preserve the life of the planet, to preserve the lives of all that is conducive to the great transformation of human consciousness into some degree of, or, you know, to the highest degree of evolution that's possible for us. And he would tell us, as Krishna tells Arjuna, that we don't do this by just sitting in meditation, even though in order to do it, we need to sit in meditation. Great paradox. So it's important to recognize that this whole teaching takes place in the context of a battle, of a righteous fight, which is positioned as a contest for the well-being of the higher self and the well-being of humanity. In a sense, both are true. So this is a teaching not only about how to live so that we actually are walking the path to liberation, but also how to walk the path of the world in such a way that our acts create the highest possible good for others as well as for ourselves. So this text, if you strip it down to its essentials, is really a cut to the chase instructions, the pith instructions, as the Buddhists say, for living your most authentic life. So with that thought, with that understanding, we're going to enter into our initial practice, our opening chant, our invocation, asking that the great and profound truth of the self, which in our tradition we call Shiva, but which we could equally well call Krishna, to recognize that great self is ever present, is always, always supporting us, and that in our practice we want to very much begin by placing ourselves in the hands of that which is most real, most profoundly real in our lives. We ask that by the power of our practice, all beings may have happiness and the causes of happiness. We ask that all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. We ask that all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. We ask that we and all beings know the equanimity that lies beyond grasping, hatred, and dullness. And may we know the oneness of all that lives. Allowing the base of your posture to become heavy, feeling your buttocks and thighs relaxing, releasing, sinking into the seat. Also, allow yourself to experience how with the exhalation, the body rises up through the spine and up through the crown of the head. Inhaling, allow the shoulder blades to melt onto the back. Exhaling, let the chest lift and open. Very, very gently, very softly, let yourself become aware of the breath. And as you do, also become aware of the almond-shaped flame in the center of your heart. Just become aware of its presence, knowing that this inner flame is actually present, is very real, that in your subtle body it shines, it glows, holding the full love and wisdom of your higher self. In that extraordinary truth about the human body, the inner center of the spiritual heart holds the flame of the true self. Inhaling now, feel that you breathe in the area in front of your body. You're poised inside the heart, aware of the presence of the flame, and your inhalation draws in the sphere in front of you, and your exhalation simply allows that sphere to flow back into the atmosphere. And your inhalation now takes in the sphere behind you, everything behind your back. And you may feel that you're just taking in the immediate area around your body, or you may feel that your inhalation is actually drawing in a much larger sphere, maybe even up into space itself. Inhaling and exhaling the whole area behind you. And now, drawing in the area on your right, drawing it into the very center of your being, into the heart, and then allowing it to flow out. And now the area to your left. You inhale and exhale, taking in the region below you. And the region above you. Now, begin to feel that you breathe in everything before you, behind you, to each side of you, below you, and above you. Just let each breath draw in the whole sphere around you, drawing it into the center of your body, and then allowing it to flow out. many of you have said that as you've sent me your Dharma statements, that what you've come up with is actually a version, a statement of what we could call your, which several people have called their authentic life, what I would call your enlightened self, the life of your enlightened self, your awake self. And what I've noticed, and I think a lot of you have noticed, is that nearly everyone chose a Dharma, and also I suspect a heart's desire that includes both inner truth, that is, inner self-actualization, self-realization of one kind or another, along with outer service. So what you describe in your Dharma statements is the deep intention, the recognition that your life is about expressing, finding and expressing an inner truth through action and service. And what I see in all these Dharma statements is that every one of them is a kind of a deep look at what it is that you can use as a yardstick to move forward in a liberated way, towards in a liberated path. That's also a path that engages the world in the way that is appropriate for you. I was really struck by something that Greg Miller said, quoting a psychotherapist, Adam Phillips, saying that we never know what we might become, and yet that what we want to become is very important. Because the truth is, if we don't have a sense of what we want to become, an intention, an aspiration, then we end up becoming something that we didn't intend. And those are the times when we look back at our life and actually wonder what happened, wonder where the time went. In Buddhism, this process of finding your Dharma statement and finding your heart's desire is sometimes called planting the seeds of aspiration. And what this process shows us, as again many of you have shared, is that we all have many potentials. There are different ways our life could go. But the Dharma statement actually applies to whatever road we choose, whatever way we choose to enact our public life or our very private life. Because the truth of our Dharma, the inner DNA of our Swadharma, is true for us, no matter what we actually choose to do in the external world, in the so-called external world. And actually, the most famous example of the way we can each use our gifts and skills in apparently opposite directions is the Buddha himself, or actually my own teacher, who had a very similar situation. Both of them were told their parents were told at the time of their birth that they had two roads, that they had the gift to become a leader in the external world. In Buddha's case, he had the gift to become a world monarch. That's what the hagiography says. And that he also had, in his DNA, the potential to become a great renunciate. So both possibilities were there. These seeming opposing possibilities were there. And of course, in both cases, both my teacher and Buddha, in a, of course, much more global way, became, in a sense, rulers through renunciation. And what you really see in his life is that the same gifts and skills that made him a potential leader in the world also gave him the courage and chutzpah to make a revolution in his own being. So leadership, that leadership potential can be exercised and must be exercised inwardly before it can be exercised outwardly. And another way of looking at this, of course, is that our Swadharma remains the same, whether we're leading a very public life or a very private life, that it can be enacted, and I found this utterly crucial, it can be enacted in the midst of worldly success or in the midst of worldly failure. I have friends, and I've actually had the experience myself, and as many of you have had, of finding at a time when things were going really badly on the outside, that at those moments when we really don't have a clue as to the next step forward, something about the interior Dharma will reveal itself in an interaction with another person, or in a dream, or perhaps in a feeling of deep contentment in a situation where we couldn't have imagined that we might be content. So, because our Swadharma always points us to something essential about ourselves, something that's already present that we simply have to discover. And of course, as your Swadharma relates to the criteria for correct action that we were working with last week, specifically to the third criteria, whatever is agreeable to one's own self, when we have a sense of our dharma, of our own dharma, then that idea that you make choices that are at least partly dependent on what's agreeable to you actually becomes viable for a dharmic life, because this, you know, your answer to your question, when you're in touch with your Swadharma and your heartfelt, your heart's desire, the answer to that question, whatever is agreeable to my own self, is not just what I feel like doing at the moment. In other words, it's not frivolous. It's not just about what temporarily feels good, or as the Katha Upanishad says, it's not just what feels pleasant in the moment. It's really about what feels pleasurable in the deepest sense of the word. Because if you don't, of course, have that sense of connection to the self and connection to your Swadharma, then what's agreeable to yourself might be what's agreeable to your ego or to your woundedness. So it's from that position that we're actually able to make what sometimes feel like dicey moral and ethical decisions. I have a friend who was a vegetarian for 30 years, and she chose to be a vegetarian out of a deep commitment to ahimsa, to non-harming. And a couple of years ago, she got very sick and depleted. She got chronic fatigue, what was diagnosed as chronic fatigue, and she began craving meat. And she really believed that her meat craving was a sign that, you know, some egoic part of herself, some old habit was surfacing. And until she went to a doctor who specialized in working with chronic fatigue, and he was somebody who was very knowledgeable about the right diet for your blood type. So those of you who are familiar with that particular approach to eating will figure out the next part of the story, which is that they discovered that she's a type O, and that the right diet for a type O includes a certain amount of red meat. So she began eating meat a few times a week, and her energy came back. And as her energy came back, she found that she actually could keep it up by eating just a little bit of meat, making decisions about the kind of meat she eats. And so this is a case in which the very profound teaching of non-harming were contraindicated by her body, or that is by her dharma, her duty to not cause harm to her own physical body, and she was able to learn to trust when her body's signals are actually emerging from an essential place. So what I'd like to ask you to do is sit now in a mudra that's called the Mudra of Earth, the Prithvi Mudra, and it's a very beautiful mudra for steadiness and groundedness and for really sensing into your own deep body dharma. You place your ring finger and the tip of your thumb together, and you press the ring finger and the tip of your thumb slightly together, and then you extend your other three fingers. And if you're holding the phone, you will do this with just one hand. But if your hands are free, then you'll do it with both hands. And you can place your hands. You can place the backs of your hands on your thighs, but keep your arms straight. And inhaling, breathe in now into the heart. breathe out. Now allow the inhalation to flow down towards the root of the body, down towards the belly. This is a mudra that actually activates the root chakra, the earth chakra. So you allow the breath to begin to come from the core of the pelvis. You're breathing into the core of the pelvis, out through the core of the pelvis. As you do, allow yourself to breathe in the quality of steadfastness. The quality of steadfastness. What is steadfastness? It's being grounded. It's being connected to the earth. To be deeply grounded in your own sense of dharma. It's the capacity to really sense what is agreeable to the self on the deepest level. And through this connection, through this feeling of steadfastness, begin to feel that your body is sitting like a mountain. You're feeling the solidity of the mountain, its quiet depth. Feel how the base of the mountain is so deeply rooted in the earth. Your hands in Prithvi Mudra, the earth mudra, are grounding you in a profound steadiness. And even if thoughts are coming up or questions are coming up, even if your energy is not quite steady, you can feel as though the thoughts or the flutterings of unsteady energy are just moving like birds, the way birds fly on a mountain. But the deep core is completely steady, completely steadfast, completely rooted. With your sense of your Swadharma, your recognition of your Swadharma, you imbibe the divine quality of steadfastness, the mountain-like steadiness of one who is fully poised in her own dharma. mudra, by the way, is a profound way of getting in touch with your own capacity for deep physical and inner equilibrium, the quality of steadfastness. And based on our recognition, at least for a few moments, of our capacity to actually identify with the mountain, to be the mountain, to be, through our imagination, through our awareness, one with the earth. I just want to say something about the teachings of the tradition, the teachings that we've been using as one of the criteria for making decisions about Dharma. My guru once wrote something that I've found incredibly useful over the years. He said there are two kinds of scriptures. One is, he called, pre-revelation scripture. That is to say, the teachings that priests and other people who are trying to be good people come up with in order to create order in society. And pre-revelation scriptures are often very connected to the culture of the time. And they will often tend to make absolutes out of teachings. I mean, one of them, of course, is the way the teachings of the Ten Commandments, which are deep and profound teachings, can sometimes be subject to question and interpretation. So, for example, honoring your father and your mother is a very good thing to do, but it doesn't mean that you don't do your best to free yourself from the dysfunctional aspects of your family heritage, and it doesn't mean that you allow the opinions of your parents or the elders of in your life or in your tribe to keep you from the Dharma of knowing your own self. So, pre-revelation scriptures, although valuable, are not applicable all the way along the path. Post-revelation scriptures are the ones that point us to the ultimate truth, the ones that simply go on yielding more and more profound recognitions as we walk the path. So the post-revelation teachings are based on the assumption that this universe is non-dual, that at an essential level there's nothing, there are not two substances here, that you and I, despite all our apparent differences and our different disciplines, are fundamentally not two. So from one perspective, let's say from the pre-revelation perspective, we're incredibly diverse. And from the post-revelation perspective, we are both diverse, unique, different, and one, aspects of oneself. So, for example, in the environmental movement, which is a really good example of how we might act in pre-revelation and post-revelation ways. In the environmental movement, we do our very best to improve conditions on the planet, but we do it from the position of separateness. And one thing that happens when you're acting from a position of separateness is that you're very subject to being discouraged when things go badly. You can be also elated and joyful when things go well, but the real downside of it is that when things go badly, as for example they did during the Bush administration for many people in the environmental movement, a lot of crucial provisions that they had worked for years to put in place were overturned. So when you're acting from the position of separateness, even knowing that what you're working for is profoundly good, you're always doing it from the position of me acting in the world. When you're acting from a position of non-separateness, for example, if you're working with the environment, I'm thinking about this a lot this week because I've just been thinking about the environment a lot, partly because of the decision to put off the tar sands pipeline, which, like Mary Kelly, I was very happy about. But partly because the whole issue of how we practice with the earth is very, very germane to Dharma. And in the deep ecology movement, which is based on the understanding that the world, the physical world, is not different from us, that there is just one substance here, in that we recognize that whatever we do to help heal the environment is actually the environment healing itself through us. And of course, I say this because so many of you have a dharma to heal in different ways. We also recognize this in our human work with other people. We realize that it's not us healing this person, it's the other person healing themselves through us, because we're not different. One famous deep ecologist wrote, "It's not me helping save the rainforest. The rainforest is helping save itself through me." And, of course, it doesn't mean we don't try to help save the rainforest, or that we don't try to heal ourselves and that we don't try to heal others. But we do it from a different perspective. And that perspective is going to change the way we perform our actions. So in that sense, our dharma, however we express it, is essentially, our swadharma is the universe expressing itself as us. It's the self expressing itself as us. It's really the universe knowing itself through us. You know, as people like Teilhard de Chardin and Thomas Berry and Sri Aurobindo say, we are the way consciousness is evolving. We are the instruments through which consciousness evolves. And in that sense, much of our work is to clear away the schmutz that keeps us from recognizing this, the voices that are not of Dharma. You know, the voices of our parental wounds, of our shadow, of the issues we brought over from past lives, you know, of our doubts, of our confusion, of all the inessential issues that come up to tell us, oh, not this, or maybe that recognition of who I really am was just like too arrogant. And of course, we don't deal with these voices by taking them out and shooting them or saying, pull up your socks, because that isn't effective. But we don't lie down and let them roll over us either. And what we do is find skillful ways both of letting them go and of working with their residues as they show up in us. So today, we're going to do this. We're going to look at what it is to let go of some of our schmutz. And we're going to do it by going a bit deeper into Krishna's Dharma teachings. We're actually going to look at the companion teaching to better your own Dharma than the Dharma of another. Better your own Dharma than the Dharma of another. So Krishna's teaching of Dharma Yoga, which is sometimes called Karma Yoga, is contained in three lines from the Bhagavad Gita. And you don't have to write them down, because I'm going to send them to you as part of your homework. First of all, he says, balanced in mind, perform your natural dharma without attachment. Evenness of mind is yoga. So that's one of his statements about Dharma Yoga, about how to move through the world. The second thing he says is, the world is bound by actions other than those performed for the sake of sacrifice. Therefore, Arjuna, perform actions for the sake of sacrifice, free from attachment. And what he means by bound, what he means by saying that the world is bound, it's a reference, as I think most of you know, to what's sometimes called the law of karma, that basic principle, which is very much like the law of gravity that operates in our lives kind of below the surface, which says that anything we do has consequences, and that according to the motivations with which we perform an action, it's going to have consequences that we'll then have to live out. And, of course, the perspective of the Eastern teachings is that these these karmas, these results of our actions, get played out in our lives, not just in this lifetime, but in subsequent lifetimes, and that we're led on a kind of an endless round, an endless wheel, in which we keep becoming and becoming and becoming. So Dharma Yoga, is the path that allows us to become free in the midst of these karmas, in the midst of the consequences of our past actions, which actually allows us to choose actions and thoughts and motivations which will free us rather than binding us more. So Krishna's hint to Arjuna, and of course the whole Gita explains what you have to do, how you have to be in order to be able to do this, is to perform actions for the sake of sacrifice, free of attachment. And the corollary line to this, which is one that I have been pondering over for 40 years, it actually presented itself to me at a fairly early stage as the teaching I'd come into this life to really grasp, really grok. So here it is, my personal Dharma teaching. You have a right to the action alone and not to its fruits. You have a right to the action alone, but not to its fruits. Therefore, perform your action without expecting results. What my guru used to say about this line, by the way, is that the results of your actions will come to you whether you expect them or not because of the law of karma. But what Krishna is really telling Arjuna here is that performing actions without expectation actually frees you from the fear and worry and the kind of grasping impulse that so many of us attach to everything we do. So it really is, difficult as it is, an extraordinary path to truly following your Dharma. So, and finally, Krishna says, and this is another one of those gold star teachings, he says, whatever you eat, whatever you wear, whatever you do, offer it to me. In that way, you are freed of all errors and become free. You are free of all errors. Actually, the word that's used is sins. And by sins, what he means is actions that are going to end up getting you in trouble in the future. It's an amazing promise that he's making Arjuna here. If you offer everything to me, that is to say, to the Supreme Truth, to consciousness itself, if you do everything as an offering, then you're free of negative consequences. And why that should be is something that we'll talk about in a moment. Because, of course, the corollary of that offering your actions is that the actions that you're performing are actions that are motivated towards Dharma, towards goodness, towards helpfulness, that they're actions that are actually performed in line with the qualities that Krishna regards as virtues, as the divine qualities like non-harming, fearlessness, equanimity, etc. So, in other words, the actions that you offer actually do need to be filled with our very serious desire to do the best we can. Not that we don't always manage it, but that is our motivation. So this week, I want to talk a little bit about the mystical basis of this ancient idea that's really the heart of Krishna's teaching about Dharma and about sacrifice. And this is the Vedic recognition of the importance of sacrifice, or in Sanskrit the word is yajna, Yajna. Those of you who've been involved in Eastern traditions will be familiar with a practice, a ritual practice that's done in India that's actually been part of every culture, known as the fire ritual or the yajna, in which a fire is kindled and offerings are made to the fire. And this central metaphor of the sacrificial fire is at the heart of what he's saying here. So sacrifice, as you know, means making sacred. It's the basis of the word sacrament. And at the same time, sacrifice is a word that's very loaded for us, has many, many levels and layers of potentially negative associations. I know that we often associate sacrifice with giving up things that we really don't want to give up. My mother, who was a very good mother in most ways, gave up her own career ambitions and a lot of other things in order to raise four children. And she didn't really, even though she wanted to do it and she loved children, it didn't actually make her so happy. So there was always this kind of feeling in the house that she had made all these sacrifices for us and we weren't really meeting our obligations. We weren't really fulfilling the contract that she somehow expected, that what she had expected she would receive from making these sacrifices, which was, I think, a very high level of gratitude, something that's not all that easy to come by when you have 5 and 6 year old children. But so at another level, we might think of sacrifice as that very dicey process involves goats and doves and sometimes human beings, as in the story of Abraham and Isaac, or the even worst case example of Agamemnon sacrificing his daughter Iphigenia to get a good wind for his fleet. So sacrifice has kind of a bad name in certain respects, but the teaching of sacrifice in the Vedas is actually really profound. It's really, in a certain sense, the heart of deep ecology. And in the Vedas, the core texts of the Indian tradition, there is a mythological story that symbolizes this practice. And the story goes that the self-existent one, which is the name that the divine intelligence, the core divine intelligence, is given in these verses of the Rig Veda, the pure beingness at the heart of things, offers his body to become the world. His head becomes the sky. His arms the four directions. His body the earth. So the world is actually made of the body of the Supreme Being, the Supreme Consciousness. And if you're familiar with evolutionary theory, this is actually the truth. You know, even though this is a metaphorical version of the truth, that is, everything is made out of this one substance that explodes into planets and stars and everything that exists. So, but essentially what this view says, of course, is that the physical world is sacred because it's made out of divinity, it's made out of divine intelligence. And of course your body and all other bodies are also made of this sacred substance. So in the 11th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna actually gives Arjuna a vision of this. He opens Arjuna's spiritual eye, and he shows him himself, Krishna, in the form of this vast, all-encompassing light being. And Arjuna sees that everything that exists is part of Krishna's body. Everything in the past, everything in the present, all his cousins and relations, all the gods, all the ancestors, the earth itself, the planet, space, they're all contained in this vast light body. And Arjuna is overwhelmed. He nearly faints at the sight. I have a friend who had this vision during an ayahuasca trip, and he fainted. It was overwhelming. But the thing is that having had this vision, he never really forgot it, because when you can sense this, the recognition gives us this very natural recognition of the sacred quality of the world. And Krishna then goes on to explain to Arjuna that the universe is in a dynamic relationship of giving and receiving, of profound enactment of interdependence. So in the cosmic sacrifice, that is, which is actually the intertwining, the interweaving of the different parts of the sacred body with itself, the rain comes down from the atmosphere and moistens the earth. The sun gives light and warmth and vivifies the earth. And as a result, plants grow, which allows mammals, animals, and human beings to eat and prosper. And in return, you know, in return for all the sort of natural gifts that the cosmos is showering on us, our part is to nourish the earth, to cultivate the earth, to protect the earth, and to offer the fruits of the earth, both as offerings to the invisible world and also as offerings to one another. And of course, one reason why the earth is in such deep turmoil is because by taking from the earth, by turning up the earth without giving back, we're actually upsetting not just the balance of nature, but the cosmic balance itself. It's a profound act of disharmony that really we're, you know, I think that in this time we're beginning to grasp, to get. And that the other part of the sacrifice that we enact in our lives is to recognize how many gifts we receive from our fellow beings. Gifts of food, of shelter, of knowledge, you know, that we are able to live and act in this world because of the knowledge that's come down to us from others, and the knowledge that others give into the collective universe, the collective knowledge base. And also, of course, the infrastructures. So one of the most powerful meditations that you can do is to consider all the human and non-human beings who've made it possible, for example, for us to be together in this call, just on this call, from the people who arranged it, thank you, Deb, to the people who maintain the infrastructure that allows free conferencing, to the people who created the whole system of telecommunications and continue to maintain it, to the instruments we use, to the earth that holds it all, to the materials that have built our structures, to the people who've built them, to those who grow and deliver our food, to the earth which gives it forth. If you just allow yourself to contemplate the web of service that's gone into making it possible for us to be here in this moment, it's actually a staggering recognition of how we are utterly blessed by receiving the fruits of so much seva, so much service from the world and from other people. So when we recognize this, when we see this, when we realize this, and when we tune into the incredible web of service that allows us to live, when we recognize that nothing we could accomplish would be possible without all the visible and invisible help we receive, it's obvious that we want to offer back. And, of course, performing our dharma and making other kinds of offerings and help are a critical part of this, but it's also something, as Krishna tells Arjuna, that we do moment to moment with every breath. One of Krishna's beautiful teachings to Arjuna in this text is he talks about the different forms of sacrifice that yogis offer, and one of the sacrifices that he he describes is the sacrifice of offering the inhalation into the exhalation. To actually breathe as though you were making offering. So you can place yourself again in your mountain-like posture, grounding through the hips and thighs and sitting bones. Allowing the breath to flow in, bringing in the sphere on all sides of you and above and below you. Allowing the breath to flow as you draw in the world. Breathe it in, contain it in your body, and then allow it to flow out. And this time, as the breath flows out, with the breath, offer what you're moved to offer. Do you want to offer blessing or gratitude or a wish for well-being, for happiness, without making a big mental picture of what it is that you want to offer? See if you can tune into the felt sense of offering a blessing, offering gratitude, or offering the wish for happiness and health. You breathe in and take in the sphere around you. And with the exhalation, you offer back, thank you. Or may the world be blessed. Or may there be happiness. May the earth be healed. Whatever arises, letting yourself offer your blessings with the breath. Your exhalation is an offering into the sphere of this one universe, this one divine body. Form action as offering, as sacrifice. Perform action as offering without attachment to results. This is really a meta practice, as you can see, because you can actually apply it at any moment. You can work with it with your very breath, of course, with the food you eat. I was teaching a few years ago at a Zen monastery in New Mexico, and they would say at the beginning of every meal, many beings gave their lives and labor so that I may eat. May this food nourish me so that I can nourish life. So this is a way that we can eat food as an offering. And in my tradition, we actually stop for a moment before we eat and have the thought of offering the food to the divine body. So, what is the power of offering? I know that there are a lot of people here, a lot of you who have done this practice regularly and who have a sense of how powerful and profound it is. And I just want to say a couple of things about why this Dharma practice of offering your actions is so profoundly liberating. I actually feel it to be the one practice that, when all else fails, when you're completely confused about how your life is going, you can practice offering your thoughts and actions, and it'll bring you into alignment with Dharma. First of all, of course, when you practice offering your actions or your decisions or your breath or your food, it's going to automatically make you less worried about the outcome. It'll make you less nervous. It'll actually bring consciousness, presence into your actions in a very, very immediate way. It's one of the best ways there is to become conscious. I also find that offering my actions impacts the way I do them. You know, the Gita is a very devotional text. Krishna actually offers himself as the personal embodiment of divinity. But you don't have to make your offerings to a personal deity. You can really feel that you're making the offering to the sacred body of the universe or to the sacred body of all beings. But however you do this, when you're really acting, doing your actions as offering, you want to do them carefully and beautifully. Because what you do when you offer your actions is you actually invite a higher presence, a more universal presence into the action, into the room with you. And the higher presence is like a witness who invites you, who reminds you to do your best, to make your offering one that actually is pleasing and that improves the world. And it's a very lovely feeling space. It's also a great way of making your enjoyments pleasurable without clinging to them. A friend of mine was walking by the beach with his Tibetan teacher a few years ago, and my friend said, "Isn't this beautiful?" referring to the landscape. And the teacher says, "Did you remember to offer it?" And, you know, it's not something that we always think to do, is to offer something that we see that's beautiful. And yet, when you enjoy something beautiful and offer it, it not only gives a dimension of subtlety and sweetness to your enjoyment, but it also keeps you from clinging to it. You know, so much of the time when you have a good experience, we subtly try to hold on to it, to make it last, to grasp it. But just by offering it, it loosens the grip of your clinging, of your need to hold on to the moment. And in the same way, when you're making a decision, and I find this, as a person who really doesn't like to make decisions, I find this so useful. When you're making a decision and you offer the decision, then in a certain sense, it's not that you give up responsibility for it, but you give up bearing the burden of it in such a heavy way. I really think that the hardest instruction Krishna gives Arjuna is the one about letting go of attachment to the fruits of action. And yet it's also, as I've said earlier, really I would call it the royal road to freedom, moment to moment. And yet part of the paradox of this teaching is that giving up the fruits of your actions cannot be an excuse for not trying your best. And I want you to really hear this, because it's one of the things that always comes up for us when we think about doing this practice. One of my dear friends who was working as a waiter years and years ago said, you know, it's not so easy to offer the fruits of your actions when the fruits of your actions are your tips. But and that's, of course, very true, but premature detachment, in fact, it can't be an excuse for not trying. I was talking to a woman a couple of years ago who kept saying to me that she wanted to find a permanent partner, someone who would really love her. And yet, as she as she went through her life. Every time she met somebody who seemed like he was somebody that would be such a partner for her, she would automatically go into detachment. Well, whatever happens, it's okay. And what she came to realize was that that automatic detachment was actually a defense mechanism against the potential of being hurt. Maybe some of you recognize this. We go to detachment because, in a certain sense, we're afraid to throw our all into the situation. We're afraid to really go for what it is that we desire and feel that we need. So this is the paradox of the action of non-action or the practice of non-attachment. You try your hardest, which is what Krishna tells Arjuna, and then you offer it. You offer it, and you let go of the results, but not of the trying. You know, as T.S. Eliot says, for us there is only the trying. The results, the rest is not our business. So part of what we're going to be practicing this week is moving through the world with the practice of offering our actions, performing our actions as offerings. And I know that as you do this, you're going to really begin to experience the depth of how transformative this is, of how many little pickles that you normally carry around just get pulverized by this practice. But right now, we're going to work with the practice of offering in another way. We're actually going to do our offering as a way of both letting go of obstructive tendencies and also of tuning into our Dharma. So this is the practice of offering. Can be a wonderful way of starting to loosen the grip of our schmutz. It's not a substitute for the actual work that we might need to do to change our behaviors and thoughts, but it's an incredibly helpful and useful adjunct to it. And I personally have found that without the practice of offering my obstructions, some of the inner obstacles that I've had to work with just simply would not have let go. I'm convinced of it. So you can place yourself now in a comfortable posture if you would like to stretch or move your body or shake yourself out for just a moment before we sit. You can do that. And you can place yourself in a comfortable posture, grounding through the sitting bones, lifting up through the torso. And you can place your hands in the mudra of detachment. And the mudra of detachment is simply to hold your palms open in a very relaxed way. So your palms are open. The backs of your hands are on your thighs, and your arms are straight. At least start out with your arms straight. You might at a certain point in the meditation want to relax them. But you notice that if you sit with your arms straight out, with your not bent at the elbows, and your palms open, it's actually the mudra that invites. It actually invites letting go. The feeling of this mudra is that everything is just rolling out your hands, like, you know, as if water were running down your arms and running past your fingers. It's a wonderful mudra for opening, letting go. So you're sitting now in the mudra of detachment, palms up, open. Your intention is to let go of anything that obstructs your deep recognition of your inner truth, of your Dharma. And with the inhalation, you feel that the universe is breathing into your body. And with the exhalation, you offer the breath back to the universe, back to the life force. And you just let the breath flow in and out, letting the breath relax you. And you find yourself now in the grove near the Dharma tree. The tree is behind you, but you're standing a little bit away from it in a clearing. And in the middle of the clearing is a fire pit. So you're in the presence of the Dharma tree, which you're aware of. Perhaps some of you have a very deep visual sense of it. You're aware of it as a presence, as the deep presence of the world tree, the tree of life that connects earth to heaven. And in the grove that sits at the foot of the Dharma tree, in a space that's open to the sky, you see the fire pit. It's square in shape. It's slightly raised. It's surrounded by a little platform. And you can stand or seat yourself on the platform and be aware of the flames inside the fire pit. Be aware that the flames are golden, they're leaping, and there's something deeply sacred about these flames, because what you're seeing in front of you is the sacred fire of consciousness, the sacred fire of the eternal cosmic yajna, the sacrificial fire that carries the aspirations, the wishes, and also that which needs to be purified away from the earth and offers it to the heavens, offers it into the invisible world. Because fire has this capacity to consume whatever is solid and transform it so that it becomes subtle. Fire is the medium through which we reach from the visible into the invisible worlds. And you notice that beside you is a golden tray. You take this tray and you hold it in your lap. And you become aware that on this tray that you're holding are qualities in yourself that you may have noticed over your lifetime are standing in the way of the full expression of your Dharma, of your truth, of your true self. Some of them are the things that other people have been pointing out to you for years. Some of them are things that you're embarrassed about that maybe aren't so important. So become aware of what it is that you're going to place on this tray. Maybe your fear of disapproval. Maybe that little bit of arrogance. Maybe your feeling of unworthiness. Your tendency to get angry. Your very embarrassing ability to lie to get yourself out of trouble. Your fear of failure. Your confusion. The feeling that you need to control everything in your life or else something will go terribly wrong. all these qualities you're placing on the tray. Your perfectionism. The kind of perfectionism that keeps you from actually bringing things to fruition because you never think they're quite good enough. All the judgments that you make about yourself and other people. Your doubts. Your tendency to badmouth people in your life. Your feelings of superiority, of entitlement. Now you have a big pile on the golden tray. And what you're going to recognize now is that these qualities in yourself that you experience as obstructive, that cover, that veil your pure self, your true self, the self that is effortlessly in touch with his Dharma, with her Dharma, all these qualities on the tray are actually going to become fuel for the fire of consciousness. So they're profoundly important in your journey. They are the qualities that you're going to offer for transmutation. And by offering them, you're going to allow consciousness to blaze higher. And you're going to allow yourself to use the experience of your life as the fuel for liberation, for literally the experience of enlightenment, of awakening, of living in the world with the perspective of your highest Dharma. So, as the fire blazes sweetly in the fire pit, you take one of the qualities from your tray and you drop it into the fire. And as you drop it into the fire, you say swaha, which means it's offered. Arrogance, swaha. Anger, swaha. Unworthiness, swaha. The judgments that you have about yourself, swaha. So just let yourself feel how you take these qualities one by one from the golden tray. You're both honoring the qualities and you're offering them up in sacrifice. And as you offer each quality into the fire, it blazes a little higher. Keep offering. And perhaps another quality that you'd like to offer will show up, and you offer that. And now you begin to offer your gifts. You offer your kindness. You offer your aspiration. Perhaps you offer your gift for business or your empathy or your intelligence or your skill at what you do. Your wish for service. Your discernment. Whatever gifts you're aware of at this moment, you're offering each one to the fire. And each gift you offer with the thought, swaha. You're offering your obstructions and you're offering your beauty. you're offering both these apparent opposites into the fire of consciousness. Swaha. 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 And as you sit before the fire now, as you watch the flames, you recognize that this fire of consciousness has both the capacity to dissolve your obstructions and to turn your gifts into divine qualities by offering that in you which is a source of pain and suffering and confusion. You allow it to reveal its basic nature as life, as light. And by offering your gifts, your beauty, your wisdom, your attainment, you're allowing these gifts to be expressed without attachment, without clinging, without pride. You're actually stating your intention to allow yourself, to allow your gifts to be a true expression, not only of your unique divine self, but also of the divine self of the universe. That's what you're offering. You're offering everything that stands in the way of your fully living as your Dharma, and everything that contributes to your fully living as your Dharma. And now as you stare into the fire, as you look into the fire, see that the fire actually takes the form of a being of light. And you recognize that this being of light is your own free self, your own free consciousness. And you see that as you gaze into the fire into which you've offered that in you which is holding you back and that in you which is impelling you forward, you experience the exquisite love and care that this being, which is your higher self, your true self, has for your small self. And as you look into the light of the sacred fire, you inhale and you feel the fire entering your body through the breath. And the light of the sacred flame filling your body. And with each inhalation and each exhalation, you let yourself be present to the truth that you are that blazing light of consciousness, the dharmic self, the one you always already are, uniquely you and utterly one with all that is. Just hold that intention to recognize the light of your own self, the light of your own truth. And let yourself be that. The end of the Bhagavad Gita, in the beautiful commentary by Yaneshwar Maharaj, the great non-dual realizer of 13th century India, Krishna says, now ease into your dharma, ease into your dharma, and become that which you must be. For all time, as yourself, right now, ease into your dharma and become that which you must be. For all time, as yourself, right now. And this is really what we're all about, is easing into our dharma, being that which we already are. Allowing the light of our own consciousness to use our obstructions as fuel for her fire, for his fire. And allowing our essential swadharma to express itself through every breath as an offering, the self offering itself back to the self. So this week you'll be working with practices of offering, and I'm going to send you this meditation, so in case you'd like to continue it, it's a very, very powerful practice to do on your own. We'll continue our meditation and the listserv will remain open. And as we conclude this conversation for now, just know that if anything comes up, you can ask me a question. And that as you continue to send in your Dharma statements, they'll all be collected and you'll receive by the end of the week a sheet of paper that gives you a sense of everybody's Dharma statements, not without their names. We're keeping them private, but just so you get a sense of what each of you is contemplating. And I'd like to say what a complete gift it is to be practicing with all of you, to be turning over these questions, to be looking at this unbelievably powerful and sacred text, and at the ways we can make it real in our lives. So with gratitude and with love, I wish you a beautiful week, a beautiful practice. I know we'll meet again on the listserv and in the future. So many blessings, so much love to all of you. Namaste. Good night.